quite fascinated by Razumihin. No sooner had she left the room than the sick man flung off the bedclothes and leaped out of bed like a madman. With burning, switching impatience, he had waited for them to be gone so that he might set to work. But to what work? Now, as though to spite him, it eluded him. Good God, only tell me one thing. Do they know of it yet, or not? What if they know it and are only pretending? Mocking me while I am laid up. And then they will come in and tell me that it's been discovered long ago and that they have only... What am I to do now? That's what I've forgotten, as though on purpose. Forgotten it all at once. I remembered a minute ago. He stood in the middle of the room and gazed in miserable bewilderment about him. He walked to the door, opened it, listened. But that wasn't what he wanted. Suddenly, as though recalling something, he rushed to the corner where there was a hole under the paper, began examining it, put his hand into the hole, fumbled. But that was not it. He went to the stove, opened it, and began rummaging in the ashes. The frayed edges of his trousers and the rags cut off his pocket were lying there just as he had thrown them. No one had looked then. Then he remembered the sock about which Razumihin had just been telling him. Yes, there it lay on the sofa, under the quilt. But it was so covered with dust and grime that Zamyatov could not have seen anything on it. Bah, Zamyatov! The police office! And why am I sent for to the police office? Where's the notice? Bah! I am mixing it up. That was then. I looked at my sock then, too, but now... Now I have been ill. But what did Zamyatov come for? Why did Razumihin bring him? He muttered, helplessly sitting on the sofa again. What does it mean? Am I still in delirium, or is it real? I believe it is real. Ah, I remember. I must escape. Make haste to escape. Yes, I must. I must escape. Yes. But where? And where are my clothes? I've no boots. They've taken them away. They've hidden them. I understand. Ah, here is my coat. They passed that over. And here is money on the table. Thank God. And here's the IOU. I'll take the money and go and take another lodging. They won't find me. Yes, but the address bureau. They'll find me. Razumihin will find me. Better escape altogether. Far away. To America. And let them do their worst. And take the IOU. It would be of use there. What else shall I take? They think I am ill. They don't know that I can walk. I could see by their eyes that they know all about it. If only I could get downstairs. And what if they have set a watch there? Policeman. What's this tea? Ah, and here is beer left, half a bottle, cold. He snatched up the bottle, which still contained a glassful of beer, and gulped it down with relish, as though quenching a flame in his breast. But in another minute the beer had gone to his head, and a faint and even pleasant shiver ran down his spine. He lay down and pulled the quilt over him. His sick and incoherent thoughts grew more and more disconnected, and soon a light, pleasant drowsiness came upon him. With a sense of comfort he nestled his head in the pillow, wrapped more closely about him the soft, wadded quilt which had replaced the old ragged greatcoat, sighed softly, and sank into a deep, sound, refreshing sleep. He woke up hearing someone come in. He opened his eyes, and saw Razumihin standing in the doorway, uncertain whether to come in or not.
Raskolnikov sat up quickly on the sofa and gazed at him as though trying to recall something.
"Ah, you are not asleep. Here I am. Nastasya, bring in the parcel."
Razumihin shouted down the stairs. "You shall have the account directly."
"What time is it?" asked Raskolnikov, looking around uneasily.
"Yes, you had a fine sleep, brother. It's almost evening. It'll be 6 o'clock directly. You have slept more than 6 hours."
"Good heavens! Have I?"
"And why not? It'll do you good. What's the hurry? A tryst, is it? We've all the time in the world. I've been waiting for the last 3 hours for you. I've been up twice and found you asleep. I've called on Zosimov twice. Not at home, fancy that. But no matter, he'll turn up. And I've been out on my own business, too. You know, I've been moving today, moving with my uncle. I have an uncle living with me now. But that's no matter. To business. Give me the parcel, Nastasya. We will open it directly. And how do you feel now, brother?"
"I am quite well. I am not ill."
"Razumihin, have you been here long?"
"I tell you, I've been waiting for the last 3 hours."
"No, before."
"How do you mean?"
"How long have you been coming here?"
"Why, I told you all about it this morning, don't you remember?"
Raskolnikov pondered. The morning seemed like a dream to him. He couldn't remember alone, and looked inquiringly at Razumihin.
"Hm," said the latter, "he has forgotten. I fancied then that you were not quite yourself. Now you're better for your sleep. You really look much better. First rate.
Well, to business. Look here, my boy."
He began untying the bundle, which evidently interested him.
"Believe me, brother, this is something specially near my heart, for we must make a man of you. Let's begin from the top. You see this cap?" he said, taking out of the bundle a fairly good, though cheap, and ordinary cap. "Let me try it on."
"Presently, afterwards," said Raskolnikov, waving it off pettishly.
"Come, Rodya, my boy, don't oppose it. Afterwards will be too late, and I shan't sleep all night, for I bought it by guess, without measure."
"Just right," he cried triumphantly, fitting it on. "Just your size. A proper head covering is the first thing in dress, and a recommendation in its own way. Tolstyakov, a friend of mine, is always obliged to take off his pudding basin when he goes into any public place where other people wear their hats or caps. People think he does it from slavish politeness, but it's simply because he is ashamed of his bird's nest. He's such a bashful fellow. Nastasya, look, here are two specimens of headgear. This Palmerston," he took from the corner Raskolnikov's old battered hat, which for some unknown reason he called a Palmerston, "or this jewel. Guess the price, Rodya." "What do you suppose I paid for it, Nastasya?" he said, turning to her, seeing that Raskolnikov did not speak.
20 kopecks, no more, I dare say," answered Nastasya.
20 kopecks? Silly!" he cried, offended. "Why, nowadays, you would cost more than that.
80 kopecks. And that only because it has been worn. And it's bought on condition that when it's worn out, they will give you another next year. Yes, on my word.
Well, now let us pass to the United States of America, as they called them at school. I assure you I am proud of these breeches."
And he exhibited to Raskolnikov a pair of light summer trousers of grey woolen material.
"No holes, no spots, and quite respectable, although a little worn, and a waistcoat to match, quite in the fashion. And its being worn really is an improvement. It's softer, smoother. You see, Rodya, to my thinking, the great thing for getting on in the world is always to keep to the seasons. If you don't insist on having asparagus in January, you keep your money in your purse. And it's the same with this purchase. It's summer now, so I've been buying summer things. Warmer materials will be wanted for autumn, so you will have to throw these away in any case. Especially as they will be done for by then.
from their own lack of coherence, if not your higher standard of luxury. Come, price them. What do you say? 2 rubles, 25 kopecks. And remember the conditions. If you wear these out, you will have another suit for nothing. They only do business on that system at Fedyaev's. If you've bought a thing once, you are satisfied for life. For you will never go there again of your own free will. Now, for the boots. What do you say? You see that they are a bit worn, but they'll last a couple of months, for it's foreign work and foreign leather. The secretary of the English embassy sold them last week. He had only worn them 6 days, but he was very short of cash. Price?
1.5 rubles.
A bargain?
But perhaps they won't fit,
observed Nastasya. Not fit? Just look! And he pulled out of his pocket Raskolnikov's old, broken boot, stiffly coated with dry mud. I didn't go empty-handed. They took the size from this monster. We all did our best. And as to your linen, your landlady has seen to that. Here, to begin with, are 3 shirts. Coarse, but with a fashionable front. Well, now then, 80 kopecks the cap, 2 rubles, 25 kopecks the suit, together 3 rubles, 5 kopecks. 1.5 rubles for the boots, for you see, they are very good, and that makes 4 rubles, 55 kopecks. 5 rubles for the underclothes. They were bought in the lot, which makes exactly 9 rubles, 55 kopecks. 45 kopecks change in coppers. Would you take it? And so, Rodya, you are set up with a complete new wardrobe, for your overcoat will serve, and even has a style of its own. That comes from getting one's clothes from Sharmer's. As for your socks and other things, I leave them to you. We've 25 rubles left. And as for Pashinka, and paying for your lodging, don't you worry. I tell you, she'll trust you for anything. And now, brother, let me change your linen, for I dare say you will throw off your illness with your shirt. Let me be. I don't want to. Raskolnikov waved him off. He had listened with disgust to Razumihin's efforts to be playful about his purchases. Come, brother, don't tell me I've been trudging around for nothing, Razumihin insisted. Nastasya, don't be bashful, but help me. That's it. And in spite of Raskolnikov's resistance, he changed his linen. The latter sank back on the pillows, and for a minute or two said nothing. It will be long before I get rid of them, he thought. What money was all that bought with? He asked at last, gazing at the wall. Money? Why, your own. What the messenger brought from Vakhrushin. Your mother sent it. Have you forgotten that, too? I remember now, said Raskolnikov after a long, sullen silence. Razumihin looked at him, frowning and uneasy. The door opened, and a tall, stout man, whose appearance seemed familiar to Raskolnikov, came in.
Zossimov, at last! Cried Razumihin, delighted.
Chapter 4
Zossimov was a tall, fat man with a puffy, colorless, clean-shaven face and straight flaxen hair. He wore spectacles and a big gold ring on his fat finger. He was 27. He had on a light gray, fashionable loose coat, light summer trousers, and everything about him loose, fashionable, and spick and span. His linen was irreproachable. His watch chain was massive. In manner, he was slow and, as it were, nonchalant, and at the same time studiously free and easy. He made efforts to conceal his self-importance, but it was apparent at every instant. All his acquaintances found him tedious, but said he was clever at his work.
"I've been to you 2 times today, brother. You see, he's come to himself," cried Razumihin.
I see, I see. And how do we feel now, eh? Said Zossimov to Raskolnikov.
Watching him carefully and sitting down at the foot of the sofa, he settled himself as comfortably as he could.
He's still depressed, Razumihin went on. We've just changed his linen and he almost cried.
That's very natural. You might have put it off if he didn't wish it. His pulse is first rate. Is your head still aching, eh?
I am well. I am perfectly well, Raskolnikov declared positively and irritably.
He raised himself on the sofa and looked at them with glittering eyes, but sank back onto the pillow at once and turned to the wall. Zossimov watched him intently.
Very good. As it should be, he said lazily. Has he eaten anything?
They told him, and asked what he might have.
He may have anything. Soup, tea. Mushrooms and cucumbers, of course, you must not give him.
He'd better not have meat either, and... But no need to tell you that. Razumihin and he looked at each other.
No more medicine or anything.
I'll look at him again tomorrow. Perhaps today, even. But never mind.
Tomorrow evening I shall take him for a walk, said Razumihin. We are going to the Yusupov Garden, and then to the Palais du Cristal.
I would not disturb him tomorrow at all. But I don't know. A little, maybe. But we'll see.
Ach, what a nuisance. I've got a housewarming party tonight. It's only a step from here. Couldn't he come? He could lie on the sofa. You are coming, Razumihin said to Zossimov. Don't forget you promised.
All right, only rather later. What are you going to do?
Oh, nothing. Tea, vodka, herrings. There'll be a pie, just our friends.
And who?
All neighbors here. Almost all new friends, except my old uncle. And he's new, too. He only arrived in Petersburg yesterday to see to some business of his. We meet once in 5 years.
What is he?
He's been stagnating all his life as a district postmaster. Gets a little pension. He's 65, not worth talking about. But I am fond of him. Porfiry Petrovich, the head of the investigation department here, but you know him.
Is he a relation of yours, too?
A very distant one. But why are you scowling?
Because you quarreled once? Won't you come, then?
I don't care a damn for him.
So much the better. Well, there'll be some students, a teacher, a government clerk, a musician, an officer, and Zamyatov.
Do tell me, please, what you or he, Zossimov nodded at Raskolnikov, can have in common with this Zamyatov.
You're such a particular gentleman. Principles. You are worked by principles as if they were springs. You won't move on your own. If a man is a nice fellow, that's the only principle I go on. Zamyatov is a delightful person.
Though he does take bribes.
Well, he does, and what of it?
I don't care if he does take bribes, Razumihin cried with unnatural irritability.
I don't praise him for taking bribes. I only say he's a nice man in his own way. But if one looks at men in all ways, are there many good ones left? Why, I'm sure I shouldn't be worth a baked onion myself, perhaps with you thrown in.
That's too little. I'd give two for you.
And I wouldn't give more than one for you. No more of your jokes. Zamyatov is no more than a boy. I can pull his hair. You've got to be nice to him, not repel him. You'll never improve a man by repelling him, especially a boy. One has to be twice as careful with a boy. Oh, you progressive dullards. You don't understand. You harm yourselves, running another man down. But if you want to know, we really have something in common.
I should like to know what.
Why, it's all about a house painter. We're getting him out of a mess. Though, indeed, there's nothing to fear now. The matter is absolutely self-evident.
We only put on steam.
A painter?
Why, haven't I told you about it? I only told you the beginning, then, about the murder of the old pawnbroker woman. Well, the painter is mixed up in it.
Oh, I heard about that murder before, and was rather interested in it. Partly for one reason. I read about it in the papers, too.
Lizaveta was murdered, too,
Nastasya blurted out, suddenly addressing Raskolnikov.
She remained in the room all the time, standing by the door, listening.
Lizaveta, murmured Raskolnikov, hardly audibly.
Lizaveta, who sold old clothes, didn't you know her? She used to come here. She mended a shirt for you, too.
Raskolnikov turned to the wall, where in the dirty yellow paper he picked out one clumsy white flower with brown lines on it, and began examining how many petals there were in it, how many scallops in the petals, and how many lines on them. He felt his arms and legs as lifeless as though they had been cut off. He didn't attempt to move, but stared obstinately at the flower.
"But what about the painter?"
Zosimov interrupted Nastasya's chatter with marked displeasure. She sighed and was silent.
"Why, he was accused of the murder,"
Razumihin went on hotly. "Was there evidence against him, then?"
"Evidence, indeed, evidence that was no evidence. And that's what we have to prove. It was just like they jumped on those fellows Koch and Pestryakov at first. Phew, how stupidly it's all done. It makes one sick, though it's not one's business. Pestryakov may be coming tonight. By the way, Rodya, you've heard about the business already. It happened before you were ill, the day before you fainted at the police office while they were talking about it."
Zosimov looked curiously at Raskolnikov. He didn't stir.
"Razumihin, I wonder at you. What a busybody you are," Zosimov observed.
"Maybe I am, but we'll get him off anyway," shouted Razumihin, bringing his fist down on the table. "What's the most offensive is not their lying. One can always forgive lying. Lying is a delightful thing, for it leads to truth. What is offensive is that they lie and worship their own lying. I respect Porfiry, but what threw them off track at first? The door was locked, and when they came back with the porter, it was open. So it followed that Koch and Pestryakov were the murderers. That was their logic.
But don't excite yourself. They simply detained them. They couldn't help that. And by the way, I've met that man, Koch. He used to buy unredeemed pledges from the old woman, eh? Yes, he is a swindler. He buys up bad debts, too. He makes a profession of it. But enough of him. Do you know what makes me angry? It's their sickening, rotten, petrified routine. And this case might be the means of introducing a new method. One can show from the psychological data alone how to get on the track of the real man. We have facts, they say. But facts are not everything. At least half the business lies in how you interpret them.
Can you interpret them, then?
Anyway, one can't hold one's tongue when one has a feeling, a tangible feeling that one might be a help if only... Ah! Do you know the details of the case?
I am waiting to hear about the painter.
Oh, yes, well, here's the story. Early on the third day after the murder, when they were still fussing about Koch and Pestryakov, though they accounted for every step they took, and it was as plain as a pikestaff, an unexpected fact turned up. A peasant called Dushkin, who keeps a dram shop facing the house, brought to the police office a jeweler's case containing some gold earrings, and told a long rigmarole. "The day before yesterday, just after 8 o'clock, mark the day and the hour, a journeyman house painter, Nikolai, who had been in to see me already that day, brought me this box of gold earrings and stones, and asked me to give him 2 rubles for them.
When I asked him where he got them, he said that he picked them up in the street. I didn't ask him anything more.
I'm telling you Dushkin's story.
I gave him a note, a ruble, that is, for I thought if he did not pawn it with me, he would with another. It would all come to the same thing. He'd spend it on drink, so the thing had better be with me. The further you hide it, the quicker you will find it, and if anything turns up, if I hear any rumors, I'll take it to the police. Of course, that's all taradiddle. He lies like a horse, for I know this Dushkin. He is a pawnbroker and a receiver of stolen goods. And he did not cheat Nikolai out of a 30-ruble trinket in order to give it to the police. He was simply afraid. But no matter. To return to Dushkin's story. I have known this peasant, Nikolai Dyamentyev, from a child. He comes from the same province and district of Zaraisk. We are both Ryazan men. And though Nikolai is not a drunkard, he drinks. And I knew he had a job in that house. Painting work with Dmitri, who comes from the same village, too. As soon as he got the ruble, he changed it, had a couple of glasses, took his change, and went out. But I did not see Dmitri with him then. And the next day I heard that someone had murdered Alyona Ivanovna and her sister Lizaveta Ivanovna with an axe. I knew them. And I felt suspicious about the earrings at once, for I knew the murdered woman lent money on pledges. I went to the house and began to make careful inquiries without saying a word to anyone. First of all, I asked, "Is Nikolai here?" Dmitri told me that Nikolai had gone off on a spree. He had come home at daybreak drunk, stayed in the house about 10 minutes, and went out again. Dmitri didn't see him again, and is finishing the job alone. And their job is on the same staircase as the murder, on the second floor. When I heard all that, I didn't say a word to anyone. That's Dushkin's tale. But I found out what I could about the murder, and went home feeling as suspicious as ever. And at 8 o'clock this morning, that was the third day, you understand, I saw Nikolai coming in, not sober, though not so very drunk. He could understand what was said to him. He sat down on the bench and didn't speak. There was only one stranger in the bar, and a man I knew asleep on a bench, and our two boys. "Have you seen Dmitri?" said I. "No, I haven't," said he. "And you've not been here either?" "Not since the day before yesterday," said he. "And where did you sleep last night?" "In Pieski, with the Kolomensky men." "And where did you get those earrings?" I asked. "I found them in the street." And the way he said it was a bit queer. He didn't look at me. "Did you hear what happened that very evening, at that very hour, on that same staircase?" said I. "No," said he. "I had not heard." And all the while he was listening, his eyes were starting out of his head, and he turned as white as chalk. I told him all about it, and he took his hat and began getting up. I wanted to keep him. "Wait a bit, Nikolai," said I. "Won't you have a drink?" And I signed to the boy to hold the door, and I came out from behind the bar, but he darted out and down the street to the corner at a run. I have not seen him since. Then my doubts were at an end. It was his doing, as clear as could be.
"I should think so," said Zosimov.
"Wait, hear the end. Of course, they sought high and low for Nikolai. They detained Dushkin and searched his house. Dmitri, too, was arrested. The Kolomensky men also were turned inside out. And the day before yesterday, they arrested Nikolai in a tavern at the end of the town. He had gone there, taken the silver cross off his neck, and asked for a dram for it. They gave it to him. A few minutes afterwards, the woman went to the cowshed, and through a crack in the wall she saw in the stable adjoining he had made a noose of his sash from the beam, stood on a block of wood, and was trying to put his neck in the noose. The woman screeched her hardest. People ran in. So that's what you are up to. "Take me," he says, "to such and such a police office. I'll confess everything."
Well, they took him to that police station. That is, here, with a suitable escort. So they asked him this and that, how old he is, 22, and so on. At the question, "When you were working with Dmitri, didn't you see anyone on the staircase at such and such a time?" Answer, "To be sure, folks may have gone up and down, but I didn't notice them." "And didn't you hear anything, any noise, and so on?" "We heard nothing special." "And did you hear, Nikolai, that on the same day widow so-and-so and her sister were murdered and robbed?" "I never knew a thing about it. The first I heard of it was from Afanasy Pavlovich, the day before yesterday." "And where did you find the earrings?"
"I found them on the pavement."
"Why didn't you go to work with Dmitri the other day?"
"Because I was drinking."
"And where were you drinking?"
"Oh, in such and such a place."
"Why did you run away from Dushkin's?"
"Because I was awfully frightened."
"What were you frightened of?"
"That I should be accused."
"How could you be frightened if you felt free from guilt?"
"Now, Zossimov, you may not believe me. That question was put literally in those words. I know it for a fact. It was repeated to me exactly.
What do you say to that?"
"Well, anyway, there's the evidence."
"I am not talking of the evidence now. I am talking about that question, of their own idea of themselves." "Well, so they squeezed and squeezed him, and he confessed.
I did not find it in the street, but in the flat where I was painting with Dmitri."
"And how was that?"
"Why, Dmitri and I were painting there all day, and we were just getting ready to go, and Dmitri took a brush and painted my face, and he ran off, and I after him. I ran after him, shouting my hardest, and at the bottom of the stairs I ran right against the porter and some gentlemen. And how many gentlemen were there I don't remember. And the porter swore at me, and the other porter swore too, and the porter's wife came out and swore at us too. And a gentleman came into the entry with a lady, and he swore at us too, for Dmitri and I lay right across the way. I got hold of Dmitri's hair and knocked him down and began beating him. And Dmitri, too, caught me by the hair and began beating me. But we did it all not for temper, but in a friendly way, for sport. And then Dmitri escaped and ran into the street, and I ran after him. But I didn't catch him, and went back to the flat alone. I had to clear up my things. I began putting them together, expecting Dmitri to come, and there in the passage, in the corner by the door, I stepped on the box. I saw it lying there, wrapped up in paper. I took off the paper, saw some little hooks, undid them, and in the box were the earrings. Behind the door? Lying behind the door?" Raskolnikov cried suddenly, staring with a blank look of terror at Razumihin. And he slowly sat up on the sofa, leaning on his hand. "Yes, why? What's the matter? What's wrong?" Razumihin, too, got up from his seat.
"Nothing,"
Raskolnikov answered faintly, turning to the wall. All were silent for a while.
"He must have waked from a dream," Razumihin said at last, looking inquiringly at Zossimov.
The latter slightly shook his head.
"Well, go on," said Zossimov. "What next?"
"What next? As soon as he saw the earrings, forgetting Dmitri and everything, he took up his cap and ran to Dushkin, and, as we know, got a ruble from him. He told a lie, saying he found them in the street, and went off drinking. He keeps repeating his old story about the murder. I knew nothing of it, never heard of it, till the day before yesterday. And why didn't you come to the police till now? I was frightened. And why did you try to hang yourself? From anxiety." "What anxiety?" "That I should be accused of it."
"Well, that's the whole story.
And now, what do you suppose they deduced from that?"
"Why, there's no supposing. There's a clue, such as it is, a fact. You wouldn't have your painter set free."
"Now they've simply taken him for the murderer. They haven't a shadow of doubt.
"That's nonsense. You are excited. But what about the earrings? You must admit that if on the very same day and hour earrings from the old woman's box have come into Nikolai's hands, they must have come there somehow. That's a good deal in such a case. How did they get there? How did they get there?" cried Razumihin. "How can you, a doctor, whose duty it is to study man, and who has more opportunity than anyone else for studying human nature, how can you fail to see the character of the man in the whole story? Don't you see at once that the answers he has given in the examination are the holy truth? They came into his hand precisely as he has told us. He stepped on the box and picked it up. The holy truth. But didn't he admit himself that he told a lie at first? Listen to me. Listen attentively. The porter and Koch and Pestryakov, and the other porter, and the wife of the first porter, and the woman who was sitting in the porter's lodge, and the man Kryukov, who had just got out of a cab at that minute and went in at the entry with a lady on his arm, that is, 8 or 10 witnesses, agree that Nikolai had Dmitri on the ground, was lying on him, beating him, while Dmitri hung on to his hair, beating him too. They lay right across the way, blocking the thoroughfare. They were sworn at on all sides while they, like children, the very words of the witnesses, were falling over one another, squealing, fighting, and laughing with the funniest faces. And chasing one another like children, they ran into the street. Now, take careful note. The bodies upstairs were warm. You understand? Warm when they found them. If they, or Nikolai alone, had murdered them and broken open the boxes, or simply taken part in the robbery, allow me to ask you one question. Do their state of mind, their squeals and giggles and childish scuffling at the gate, fit in with axes, bloodshed, fiendish cunning, robbery? They just killed them not 5 or 10 minutes before, for the bodies were still warm, and at once, leaving the flat open, knowing that people would go there at once, flinging away their booty, they rolled about like children, laughing and attracting general attention. And there are a dozen witnesses to swear to that. Of course, it is strange. It's impossible indeed, but no, brother, no buts. And if the earrings being found in Nikolai's hands at the very day and hour of the murder constitutes an important piece of circumstantial evidence against him, although the explanation given by him accounts for it, and therefore it does not tell seriously against him, one must take into consideration the facts which prove him innocent, especially as they are facts that cannot be denied. And do you suppose, from the character of our legal system, that they will accept, or that they are in a position to accept, this fact, resting simply on a psychological impossibility, as irrefutable, and conclusively breaking down the circumstantial evidence for the prosecution? No, they won't accept it. They certainly won't. Because they found the jewel case, and the man tried to hang himself, which he could not have done if he hadn't felt guilty. That's the point. That's what excites me. You must understand. Oh, I see you are excited. Wait a bit. I forgot to ask you. What proof is there that the box came from the old woman? That's been proved, said Razumihin with apparent reluctance, frowning. Koch recognized the jewel case and gave the name of the owner, who proved conclusively that it was his. That's bad. Now another point. Did anyone see Nikolai at the time that Koch and Pestryakov were going upstairs at first? And is there no evidence about that? Nobody did see him, Razumihin answered with vexation. That's the worst of it. Even Koch and Pestryakov did not notice them on their way upstairs, though, indeed, their evidence could not have been worth much.
They said they saw the flat was open, and that there must be work going on in it, but they took no special notice, and couldn't remember whether there actually were men at work in it.
So the only evidence for the defense is that they were beating one another and laughing. That constitutes a strong presumption, but how do you explain the facts yourself?
How do I explain them? What is there to explain? It's clear. At any rate, the direction in which explanation is to be sought is clear, and the jewel case points to it. The real murderer dropped those earrings. The murderer was upstairs, locked in, when Koch and Pestryakov knocked at the door. Koch, like an ass, did not stay at the door, so the murderer popped out and ran down, too, for he had no other way of escape. He hid from Koch, Pestryakov, and the porter in the flat when Nikolai and Dmitri had just run out of it. He stopped there while the porter and others were going upstairs, waited till they were out of hearing, and then went calmly downstairs at the very minute when Dmitri and Nikolai ran out into the street, and there was no one in the entry. Possibly he was seen but not noticed. There are lots of people going in and out. He must have dropped the earrings out of his pocket when he stood behind the door, and didn't notice he dropped them because he had other things to think of. The jewel case is a conclusive proof that he did stand there. That's how I explain it.
Too clever. No, my boy, you're too clever. That beats everything. But why? Why? Why, because everything fits too well. It's too melodramatic.
Ah! Zamykin was exclaiming, but at that moment the door opened, and a personage came in who was a stranger to all present.
Chapter 5.
This was a gentleman, no longer young, of a stiff and portly appearance, and a cautious and sour countenance. He began by stopping short in the doorway, staring about him with offensive and undisguised astonishment, as though asking himself what sort of place he had come to. Mistrustfully, and with an affectation of being alarmed and almost affronted, he scanned Raskolnikov's low and narrow cabin. With the same amazement he stared at Raskolnikov, who lay undressed, disheveled, unwashed, on his miserable dirty sofa, looking fixedly at him. Then, with the same deliberation, he scrutinized the uncouth, unkempt figure and unshaven face of Razumihin, who looked him boldly and inquiringly in the face without rising from his seat. A constrained silence lasted for a couple of minutes, and then, as might be expected, some scene-shifting took place. Reflecting, probably from certain fairly unmistakable signs, that he would get nothing in this cabin by attempting to overawe them, the gentleman softened somewhat, and civilly, though with some severity, emphasizing every syllable of his question, addressed Zosimov.
Rodion Romanovich Raskolnikov, a student or formerly a student?
Zosimov made a slight movement and would have answered, had not Razumihin anticipated him.
Here he is lying on the sofa. What do you want?
This familiar, "what do you want," seemed to cut the ground from the feet of the pompous gentleman. He was turning to Razumihin, but checked himself in time and turned to Zosimov again.
"This is Raskolnikov," mumbled Zosimov, nodding towards him. Then he gave a prolonged yawn, opening his mouth as wide as possible. Then he lazily put his hand into his waistcoat pocket, pulled out a huge gold watch in a round hunter's case, opened it, looked at it, and as slowly and lazily proceeded to put it back.
Raskolnikov himself lay without speaking on his back, gazing persistently, though without understanding, at the stranger. Now that his face was turned away from the strange flower on the paper, it was extremely pale, and wore a look of anguish, as though he had just undergone an agonizing operation or just been taken from the rack. But the newcomer gradually began to arouse his attention, then his wonder, then suspicion and even alarm. When Zosimov said, "This is Raskolnikov," he jumped up quickly, sat on the sofa, and, with an almost defiant but weak and breaking voice, articulated, "Yes, I am Raskolnikov. What do you want?" The visitor scrutinized him and pronounced impressively, "Pyotr Petrovich Luzhin. I believe I have reason to hope that my name is not wholly unknown to you." But Raskolnikov, who had expected something quite different, gazed blankly and dreamily at him, making no reply, as though he heard the name of Pyotr Petrovich for the first time. "Is it possible that you can, up to the present, have received no information?" asked Pyotr Petrovich, somewhat disconcerted. In reply, Raskolnikov sank languidly back on the pillow, put his hands behind his head, and gazed at the ceiling. A look of dismay came into Luzhin's face. Zosimov and Razumihin stared at him more inquisitively than ever, and at last he showed unmistakable signs of embarrassment.
"I had presumed and calculated," he faltered, "that a letter posted more than 10 days, if not a fortnight ago—"
"Why are you standing in the doorway?" Razumihin interrupted suddenly. "If you've something to say, sit down. Nastasya and you are so crowded. Nastasya, make room. Here's a chair. Thread your way in."
He moved his chair back from the table, made a little space between the table and his knees, and waited in a rather cramped position for the visitor to thread his way in. The minute was so chosen that it was impossible to refuse, and the visitor squeezed his way through, hurrying and stumbling. Reaching the chair, he sat down, looking suspiciously at Razumihin.
"No need to be nervous," the latter blurted out. "Rodya has been ill for the last 5 days and delirious for 3. But now he is recovering and has got an appetite. This is his doctor, who has just had a look at him. I am a comrade of Rodya's, like him, formerly a student, and now I am nursing him. So don't you take any notice of us, but go on with your business."
"Thank you. But shall I not disturb the invalid by my presence and conversation?"
Pyotr Petrovich asked of Zosimov.
"No," mumbled Zosimov. "You may amuse him."
He yawned again.
"He has been conscious a long time, since the morning," went on Razumihin,
whose familiarity seemed so much like unaffected good nature that Pyotr Petrovich began to be more cheerful, partly, perhaps, because this shabby and impudent person had introduced himself as a student.
"Your mama," began Luzhin.
Razumihin cleared his throat loudly. Luzhin looked at him inquiringly.
"That's all right, go on."
Luzhin shrugged his shoulders.
"Your mama had commenced a letter to you while I was sojourning in her neighborhood. On my arrival here, I purposely allowed a few days to elapse before coming to see you, in order that I might be fully assured that you were in full possession of the tidings. But now, to my astonishment—"
I know,
Raskolnikov cried suddenly with impatient vexation.
"So, you are the fiancé?"
"I know, and that's enough."
There was no doubt about Pyotr Petrovich's being offended this time, but he said nothing. He made a violent effort to understand what it all meant. There was a moment's silence. Meanwhile, Raskolnikov, who had turned a little towards him when he answered, began suddenly staring at him again with marked curiosity, as though he had not had a good look at him yet, or as though something new had struck him. He rose from his pillow on purpose to stare at him. There certainly was something peculiar in Pyotr Petrovitch's whole appearance, something which seemed to justify the title of fiancé, so unceremoniously applied to him. In the first place, it was evident, far too much so indeed, that Pyotr Petrovitch had made eager use of his few days in the capital to get himself up and outfitted in expectation of his betrothed. A perfectly innocent and permissible proceeding, indeed. Even his own, perhaps too complacent, consciousness of the agreeable improvement in his appearance might have been forgiven in such circumstances, seeing that Pyotr Petrovitch had taken up the role of fiancé. All his clothes were fresh from the tailor's, and were all right, except for being too new and too distinctly appropriate. Even the stylish new round hat had the same significance. Pyotr Petrovitch treated it too respectfully and held it too carefully in his hands. The exquisite pair of lavender gloves, real Louvain, told the same tale, if only from the fact of his not wearing them but carrying them in his hand for show. Light and youthful colors predominated in Pyotr Petrovitch's attire. He wore a charming summer jacket of a fawn shade, light thin trousers, a waistcoat of the same new and fine linen, a cravat of the lightest cambric with pink stripes on it, and the best of it was, this all suited Pyotr Petrovitch. His very fresh and even handsome face looked younger than his 45 years at all times. His dark mutton-chop whiskers made an agreeable setting on both sides, growing thickly about his shining, clean-shaven chin. Even his hair, touched here and there with grey, though it had been combed and curled at a hairdresser's, did not give him a stupid appearance, as curled hair usually does, by inevitably suggesting a German on his wedding day. If there really was something unpleasing and repulsive in his rather good-looking and imposing countenance, it was due to quite other causes. After scanning Mr. Luzhin unceremoniously, Raskolnikov smiled malignantly, sank back on the pillow, and stared at the ceiling as before. But Mr. Luzhin hardened his heart and seemed to determine to take no notice of their oddities. "I feel the greatest regret at finding you in this situation," he began, again breaking the silence with an effort. "If I had been aware of your illness, I should have come earlier. But you know what business is. I have, too, a very important legal affair in the Senate, not to mention other preoccupations which you may well conjecture. I am expecting your mamma and sister any minute." Raskolnikov made a movement and seemed about to speak. His face showed some excitement. Pyotr Petrovitch paused, waited, but as nothing followed, he went on.
"Any minute. I have found a lodging for them on their arrival."
"Where?" asked Raskolnikov weakly.
"Very near here, in Bakaleyev's house." "That's in Voskresensky," put in Razumihin. "There are two stories of rooms let by a merchant called Yushin. I've been there."
"Yes, rooms."
"A disgusting place. Filthy. Stinking, and, what's more, of doubtful character. Things have happened there. And there are all sorts of queer people living there, and I went there about a scandalous business. It's cheap, though. I could not, of course, find out so much about it, for I am a stranger in Petersburg myself," Pyotr Petrovitch replied huffily. "However, the two rooms are exceedingly clean, and as it is for so short a time, I have already taken a permanent, that is, our future flat," he said, addressing Raskolnikov.
and I am having it done up. And meanwhile, I am myself cramped for room in a lodging with my friend Andrei Semyonovich Lebezyatnikov, in the flat of Madame Lipevexel. It was he who told me of Bakaleev's house, too.
Lebezyatnikov?
Said Raskolnikov slowly, as if recalling something.
Yes, Andrei Semyonovich Lebezyatnikov, a clerk in the ministry. Do you know him?
Yes.
No,
Raskolnikov answered.
Excuse me, I fancied so from your inquiry. I was once his guardian, a very nice young man, and advanced. I like to meet young people. One learns new things from them.
Luzhin looked round hopefully at them all.
How do you mean? Asked Razumihin. In the most serious and essential matters, Pyotr Petrovitch replied, as though delighted at the question. You see, it's 10 years since I visited Petersburg. All the novelties, reforms, ideas have reached us in the provinces, but to see it all more clearly, one must be in Petersburg. And it's my notion that you observe and learn most by watching the younger generation. And I confess I am delighted.
At what?
Your question is a wide one. I may be mistaken, but I fancy I find clearer views, more, so to say, criticism, more practicality.
That's true, Zosimov let drop.
Nonsense! There's no practicality,
Razumihin flew at him.
Practicality is a difficult thing to find. It doesn't drop down from heaven, and for the last 200 years we've been divorced from all practical life. Ideas, if you like, are fermenting, he said to Pyotr Petrovitch, and desire for good exists, though it's in a childish form. And honesty you may find, although there are crowds of brigands. Anyway, there's no practicality. Practicality goes well shod.
I don't agree with you, Pyotr Petrovitch replied, with evident enjoyment.
Of course, people do get carried away and make mistakes, but one must have indulgence. Those mistakes are merely evidence of enthusiasm for the cause and of abnormal external environment. If little has been done, the time has been but short. Of means I will not speak. It's my personal view, if you care to know, that something has been accomplished already. New, valuable ideas, new, valuable works are circulating in the place of our old, dreamy and romantic authors. Literature is taking a maturer form. Many injurious prejudices have been rooted up and turned into ridicule. In a word, we have cut ourselves off irrevocably from the past, and that, to my thinking, is a great thing.
He's learnt it by heart, to show off, Raskolnikov pronounced suddenly.
What?
Asked Pyotr Petrovitch, not catching his words, but he received no reply.
That's all true, Zosimov hastened to interpose. Isn't it so? Pyotr Petrovitch went on, glancing affably at Zosimov. You must admit, he went on, addressing Razumihin with a shade of triumph and superciliousness, he almost added young man,
that there is an advance, or, as they say now, progress, in the name of science and economic truth.
A platitude.
No, not a platitude. Hitherto, for instance, if I were told, love thy neighbor, what came of it? Pyotr Petrovitch went on, perhaps with excessive haste. It came to my tearing my coat in half to share with my neighbor, and we both were left half naked. As a Russian proverb has it, catch several hares, and you won't catch one.
Science now tells us, love yourself before all men, for everything in the world rests on self-interest. You love yourself and manage your own affairs properly.